thank you, Jeff, and I want to say that I'm very honored to be here as a part of a program of so distinguished a society as the Philadelphia Society. My topic was not generated by myself. This is probably not unusual here. I received an assignment from Bill Campbell. And when I told some people who were colleagues at Baylor the title that he had suggested, Israel and Revelation, there was visible anxiety in their faces. And I realized that coming from that part of the world, they were thinking of televangelists and nervous-making things. It's interesting that I was later on the East Coast, and I mentioned this title, and some other people had nervous faces, and they were thinking about the apocalyptic fantasists on J Street. Whatever your imaginary in regard to this, I'm not thinking about Revelation, the book, with you this morning. I'm thinking about Revelation, the concept. And I want to suggest to begin with that even as a vestigial trope, this concept has purchase in our culture. There's a little convenience store near where I live, and if you go in, it's operated by new immigrants from Asia. You'll see a little sign with a cash register, and it says, "In God we trust, all else pay cash." And what I want to say is that this cliche is silently, perhaps, or unconsciously contrasting historic convictions regarding the relationship between revelation and moral order on the one hand, and a widespread current pragmatic cynicism for what is effectively social contract theory as an alternative guarantor of moral responsibility. This prudential cynicism prompts reflection on my part on the basis of moral order, which is, I think, now largely lost to us. Ultimately, the claim of biblical religions, Judaism and Christianity, to a divinely defined rather than humanly constructed basis for construing ethical norms. Notably, this extraordinary claim of the biblical tradition is not attested on the grounds of superior philosophical argument. That's a Kirkian principle, and it holds here. Rather, it subsists in a legacy of moral law. Law given an extra comprehensive series of moral claims advanced not on the basis of intellectual deliberation or political process, but presented rather as a direct self-disclosure of the divine will. In Torah, a singular deity makes what Paul Johnson has aptly called absolutely clear moral distinctions, and these govern the pursuit of right action. The specific content of this revelation, typically presented as delivered in oracular fashion to Moses and later other prophets, characterizes the person of the God who speaks as well as gives his prescriptions for his people. That is, in the Hebrew Bible, God is revealed as a person in relation to human persons. Unlike us, however, he is holy, the singular perfection of wholeness. Torah grounds everything in this central aspect of divine identity, God's relation to the created world and his specific instructions for life in this world take the legal form of a covenant, the Berit, with mutual obligations much like the terms of a user's manual, specific directions so that human flourishing, which Jews call shalom, may be achieved. The Decalogue, 10 categorical imperatives in the second person singular, constitute a precis of all of written Torah, the revealed word of God. But here, throughout, it is the character of a holy God before and surpassing this precepts which warrants his authority. Holy implies W-H-O-L-L-Y, holy. It's clear that nothing could be more alien to the postmodern mind than such a claim. The entire history of modernity, as Hannah Arendt has famously argued, has been characterized by challenges to authority of all kinds. And we might add that in Western culture, no authority of any kind, be it Pope, Emperor, Congress, or Church, generally persists in the way that we once might have imagined it to do. What we are left with is contestable power. The authority of revelation was famously a target of course of the French Revolution, not least because of its apparent constraints upon the popular will, vox populi, vox Dei. Divine revelation in both Jewish and Christian versions was likewise a primary target both of Marxism and Nazism. because they deemed it entirely incompatible with another authority, namely the absolute authority of the state. Yet after World War II, even the authority of the nation state itself was in decline. And here in America, by the end of the Cold War, other far less imposing place markers for authority were coming increasingly under challenge. The 60s, in this regard, were marked by both explicit and implicit rejections of the moral authority of biblical revelation. While I was finishing my PhD at Princeton in 1968, much of the news was about what happened at Berkeley. Some of the placards carried by the chanting crowd surrounding Jerry Rubin and Abby Kaufman spelled out a major theme of the free speech movement: question authority. It has often seemed to be since that the placards might better have read, abolish consequences. For that's what many in my generation really meant. Much of liberal activism since then bears witness to their actual demand. One need think only of the Sexual Revolution, in which a whole generation seems to have edited out the first G in Descartes' Cogito Ergo Sum. Well, that is not good, I'll tell you. But the wide healthcare crisis, you know, the wider healthcare crisis is in part occasioned, of course, by unfettered appetite. And the credit collapse, likewise, worked to confirm the absurdity of our bizarre yet persistent demand for a consequence-free social order. The rhetoric of Berkeley in 1968, in which the dominant noun was rights, and the favorite verb still then unprintable, has become a little more sophisticated. Unfortunately, consequences have not been abolished, and the cost of dealing with them has steadily increased. One wonders if a representative narrative for American social history now, in 2013, might not be what happened to Detroit. There have been many attempts at retrospective analysis, yet from the perspective of what the Judeo-Christian tradition regards as the light of revelation, the epidemiology of America's unraveling may not adequately be explained simply in economic, social, or legal terms. More than a few thoughtful observers have looked at the ruins of Motown and quietly wondered if, in a holistic analysis, the wages of sin isn't about as good a phrase as any to label a retrospective diagnosis. Not many, I think, expect biblical revelation to return to the American public square. Nevertheless, I think this might be a propitious time to reconsider the Jewish legacy in our American foundation, if for no other reason than perspective. Recognition that American exceptionalism owes much to Old Testament conceptions of moral law and social obligation are fading from public memory. But the historical facts are still there. Aaron Shalev, in his brand new book, The Old Testament as Political Text from the Revolution to the Civil War, offers a catalog of reminders of the enormous role that the Old Testament had as a moral authority in the founding years of this country. No one who has read Cotton Mather, Timothy Dwight, or Samuel Willard should need the reminder. Yet the feature of biblical contributions to social and political ethics for that phase of American history has largely been discarded in contemporary discussions of moral disorder. Unfortunately, successor ideas in Kantian and post-Kantian ethics have had less evident social success in sustaining our character and energy. To think through our ethical evolution since the colonial period requires of us a willing suspension of disbelief. In short, we have to be able to reimagine somehow how revelation once worked. At one level, it's pretty simple. The basic difference between revelation and civic reason in the matter of ethics has been summarized rather nicely by Soren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard's quip is, it's just not the same thing to say to somebody, you ought to live responsibly, as to say to them, you better live responsibly because there's a last judgment coming. Kierkegaard is one of the most acute modern readers of the Judeo-Christian scriptures, and he's accordingly a fierce critic of the state church and Enlightenment reason alike. Here he reminds us that one of the first truths of revealed moral order is in fact the inevitable reality of consequences of some sort. The insight was deeply enough ingrained in past generations to have been accounted a matter of common sense or folk wisdom. Garrison Keillor, in one of his radio monologues, remarks that allusions to this principle were stock and trade of his mother's philosophy of child-rearing. Reminders of how the Lord smote his adversary's hip and thigh weighed on his willful mind, he admits. It occurred to me, Keillor says, that when the Lord smote you, you stayed smitten. Kierkegaard and Keillor, each in their way, articulate a holy axiom of revealed rather than merely social constructed moral vision. Moral order on the biblical model is not an abstraction. It is an ontological given, bearing in effect the stamp of the manufacturer. And as we might expect in lesser circumstances, the manufacturer has stipulated abuses that would negate his warranty. It's often claimed that negative formulations of biblical ethical order have led most of those who have rejected it to do so. It has also led many who do not admit to having rejected biblical revelation to soft-pedal or eschew the topic of revealed morality even in sermons. The idea that there might be an actual divine law somewhere, in some way grounding with first principles the formation of our common law, an idea assumed and even cherished from Constantine to Charlemagne and the laws of the English-speaking peoples, from Henri de Brantôme's Laws of England to the Institutes of Edward Coke, William Blackstone's Commentaries, and F.W. Maitland's History, however venerable and once authoritative a benchmark, has by now largely been abandoned in our courts. Whatever its once venerable dignity, the idea of divine justice is now only treated as an anachronism. It has become politically offensive, moreover, to our contemporaries in a way which exceeds any offense occasioned by the moral legacy of Greece, and Rome. Reminders of Israel's revelation, you know, such as little constructions of tables of the Ten Commandments, Bibles, crosses, and the like, thus have now to be taken from public view, precisely because they might suggest to somebody somewhere that there is a higher universal source of authority by which our own authority and actions might be judged. The outrage directed against vestigial witnesses to the concept of revelation makes sense, of course, for one who rejects the idea that there is a God to whom, you know, unavoidable way all are in some sense accountable, and who believes it's pernicious to social well-being when people entertain such backward ideas. Latter-day debates between the authoritarian secularists and those who still believe in a transcendent moral order to which scripture, revelation, is a guide have begun to die away. And this has come about largely through seismic shifts in the present balance of political power. Slogans with calculated double entendre, such as, we can, yes we can, and we will. Or less subtly, we're here, we're queer, get used to it, are markers of the triumph of confident political power over uncertain moral authority. In biblical language, the walls of Jerusalem have been breached from within. I have a wonderful non sequitur cartoon in the door of my office, and it shows Moses standing at the foot of the mountain, tablets in hand, evidently just having read them to the crowd, now adding a caveat. Unless, of course, you happen to live in a state in which all of this stuff is already legal. Now, what effect of the steamroller rhetoric of politicians and media and judicial activism based on the same premises is that social conservatives in the public square are in self-acknowledged disarray. As the debate over how to refocus public voice in the latest issue of First Things illustrates well enough, it's becoming increasingly hard for those who assent to a transcendent moral authority to get any airtime at all. In such a pluralistic ethos, what possible value can there be for us to revert to thinking about the Judeo-Christian moral foundation? Well, it might help to begin by asking ourselves what, on the Jewish view, was the purpose of revealed law in the first place. Here I am happy to refer to another recent book this year by Stephen Kepnes. It's entitled The Future of Jewish Theology. Kepnes assumes that the culture wars, having become unproductive and incoherent, are marginal for a useful articulation of religious values in the public square. He argues that even the modern Jewish legacy of ethical monotheism, encumbered as it has become with all sorts of Kantian baggage, has failed to prevent ethical incoherence because it has overlooked the distinctive reason for Jewish law. Kepnes goes back to the text, and he makes what seems to me an entirely warrantable conclusion. The purpose of Jewish law, he says, is precisely to map out a path through which the people of Israel can follow the commandment of God to be holy. It is the erosion of the imperative to holiness, he argues, that is diminished with drastic consequences our appreciation of the most basic fact about God, not just that he is a personal being, but that he is a holy being. God's prescription for human flourishing, if understood in Torah terms, can be stated succinctly. Kadoshim tehiyu, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. The balance of this chapter of Leviticus, that's 19, on which Kepnes' book is a kind of meditation, shows how everything else in the moral order is to this basic commandment a dependent clause. Social health is made dependent on a more or less conscious acknowledgement that we were made in the image of God. Embodiment of that understanding in all the practices of life is simply what holiness is about. This principle is reiterated, of course, in Christian calls to reformation of personal and social life through imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ. It turns out to be the case that everything about the Judeo-Christian high definition of the meaning and dignity of persons has its source in this most basic aspect of Israel's revelation. Because human beings are made in the image of God, they possess inherent dignity and the right to respect. That is the seminal form of later notions of rights. Though, in fact, Jewish moral law itself speaks in this context not of rights at all, but rather of obligations. What a focus on wholeness does, is to bring the value of the other, the person of the neighbor, and of persons in relation into view. The limits of Kantian and post-Kantian deontological ethics in this regard have been a recent subject of analysis in many quarters. In one example, Daniel Philpott's new book, Just and Unjust Peace, The Ethic of Reconciliation, points out that one of these limitations is the inevitable lack of a consensus on truth. Truth not only in regard to events, but truth as a matter of right relation. It is not enough, Philpott says, for an ethic to identify, adopt, or assert rights. It must also justify them. What grounds our notion of human rights? His own answer is diaposune, righteousness, which he finds in the letters of St. Paul as a clear equivalent for kedushah, holiness in Torah. And he regards it properly, I think, as in effect right relationship with God, a Jewish principle, evident also in Paul's use of the term in its sense of justification. To state this in another way, typically a sincere believer in revelation seeks out and is grateful for any experience of right relationship with God and neighbor, and strives by words and deeds to deepen that. Secularized rights are by contrast often demanded and received as an entitlement, requiring neither gratitude nor real relationship. On the biblical view, a durable account of rights requires something more, I suggest, than is provided by Thomas Paine or Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Succinctly, Pache, their successors, including John Rawls and Paul, a transcendent authority is necessary, an eternally dependable giver of moral law, because no merely human authority can provide the security of right relationship, except in shifting, transient, unstable terms. The answer that Israel's revelation gives to questions about how to achieve a flourishing life is thus not merely God said it, but rather, if I may paraphrase, God has disclosed something profound about his own nature in the Torah, namely that he is holy, and he wills our participation in his death. His call to us to imitate him is detailed as it is because holiness of life, as distinct from knowledge of a right or definition of agency, must be a matter of sustained living practice. On just this tour of view, says Katniss, that the ethical commandments are included along with the ritual commandments in a code of holiness means that there is a holy dimension to ethics and an ethical dimension to holiness. Moreover, and for the entire Judeo-Christian tradition, this cannot be stressed too strongly. The commandment to be holy obligates not just individuals, but whole communities. It has thus an inescapably political implication, and this is precisely the point in contention for successors of Paine and Rousseau, who wish to substitute another authority, another source of obligation, namely government. Here, needless to say, we are on the brink of the abyss for philosophers and politicians alike. Bogeyman nightmares of Puritan roundheads and other ghosts of theocracy readily rise in the defense of ethical pluralism, even if it's at the risk of anarchy. In a culture in which the kindergarten ethic begins with the commandment, thou shalt not criticize thy neighbor. Indeed, thou shalt affirm thy neighbor, even or perhaps especially when he or she is doing something that might seem wrong to you. It's not hard to see why the moral legacy of Israel can seem appropriate. It's not surprising that even religious philosophers have tried to find a common ground elsewhere than in a Torah obligation to communal holiness and its corollary, the obligation to hand down the moral law within the home and within the religious community. Natural law theory seems to many to have made the best of the modern elevation of tolerance as the sine qua non virtue. Not least because, as Rousseau noted long ago, natural law theory foregoes the necessary attachment to revelation. Thus, it can claim to be tolerant in a way that an ethic based upon divine obligation cannot. This is from the letter to Beaumont, if you're interested. Amusingly, in his significantly titled Letters from the Mountain, Rousseau entertained the idea that there might be some hope for Protestants as a basis for a more tolerant civil religion. Because amongst Protestants, each person seems to be entitled to interpret the scripture for himself. As Douglas Priest has remarked, for Rousseau, Protestant individualism is simply another way to state the principle of theological toleration. Logically, as Rousseau observes, the result of individualized interpretation is that the Protestant clergy have no authority at all. A point in which, according to Karl Barth, Rousseau has effectively anticipated the entire modern history of Protestantism and of modernity in general. For Catholics, meanwhile, natural law theory appeals as less controversial than revelation in a pluralistic setting, but at the loss of some of the leverage of biblical ontology found in Leviticus and elsewhere. It's not clear to me that any theory of ethics can remain coherent without a foundational ontology. Other alternatives, each in their own fashion, trying to ground ethics in something higher than subjectivity and self-interest, have considered Kant's notion of will, rational assent to intuitive or normative ethical obligations. Kant's deontological stand led him to regard divine command theory, essentially the Jewish as well as Christian biblical view, as not really ethics at all. Consequentialism, of which utilitarianism is a version, has in like fashion been an influence on the secularist field called virtue ethics, which attempts to derive all the moral concepts from the concept of a virtue, just as Kant tried to derive all morality from the notion of an unconditional imperative or a universal law of practical reason. Consequentialists try to derive all morality from some idea of maximized welfare that can be distributed in a population. This is a version, of course, of Bentham's greatest good for the greatest number. Robert C. Roberts describes ethical theory on these models as a hopeless conceptual mess, adding rather soberly that such theories tend to be morally detrimental to those who take them seriously. Consequences, in short, remain an issue at many levels. Construing the goal of ethical standards as nothing more than an adequation of normative behavior as a governing criteria, a kind of hyper-Baconianism, has become de facto the reflex of our current legal and political culture. If Hollywood is what most people appear to want, the court will ensure that's what all will get. If insufficient numbers want it, there will be school martyrs scolding from the media. Ironically, we have created thus a new absolute authority. Effective not least because daily proclaimed by its own prophets, the media and the entertainment industry. This oracular voice from the sky includes, of course, the news, which we consult each morning in order to learn what we are supposed to think and do, and then encourage others to do. Nor is that enough. We are prompted almost daily to join in an obligatory chorus celebrating those as courageous, even heroic, who invent a new, perhaps previously unthinkable norm. In short, we are daily being pressured by pseudo-moral imperatives to imitate beings and behaviors which may be well lower than ourselves, seduced by behavior reinforcement into a kind of infernal imitatio. But how long can we overlook the enormous costs which have already accrued to this substitute for revelation? Whether we consider the disappearance of moral authority, as Hannah Arendt construed it, or believe the issue of authority be fluid or merely temporarily problematized, we cannot evade the evidence that consequences attend not only upon ideas, but follow in real time from the moral choices cultures as well as individuals make, not just from the way they choose to ground their first principles. That seems to me to be the thesis of the countercultural television series Breaking Bad, in which, as a Los Angeles Times review noted, people who do bad things seem to get what they deserve. In this descent into cultural witness, and I'm quoting from the review, reality can't apparently be constructed by man. Rather, some kind of metaphysical truth exists, good and evil, moral, immoral, action and consequence. This is the stuff of the Old Testament. And Vince Gilligan, the show's creator, concurs. He says, if there's a larger lesson to Breaking Bad, it's that actions have consequence. And he says, frankly, I feel some sort of need for biblical atonement myself. Some need for justice or something. Well, something. It would seem that Breaking Bad implies the possibility of the good, even of breaking good. The series implies something else, it seems, namely an unacknowledged exhaustion in some quarters with the conceptual morass of an ethic whose highest principle is that thou shalt not criticize thy neighbor. What if a gesture of fraternal correction might be the only lifeline we have to offer a neighbor in the hope that he or she may avoid self-destruction? Keep your opinion to yourself, say the courts and the media. In this paralyzing context, perhaps the concept of holiness, the primary content of Israel's revelation, the notion that the most whole and healthy way of life available to us is by way of imitating something far higher than ourselves, merits at least a thoughtful retrospect. Though it may have no more hope of political influence upon our students than Plato's Republic, perhaps we might include the text of ancient Israel in our humanities curriculum, with thoughtful attention to the relation between holiness and authority as they're articulated, not least in relation to the inevitability of consequences. T.S. Eliot once said that the difference between Christians and Marxists was that the Christians had high ideals and low expectations. Marxists had you know, low ideals and very high expectations. But we live in a time in which, amongst our students, both ideals and expectations have been diminished. And in such a culture, from an educational point of view, if we think that it is useful, to use Charles Taylor's terms, you know, in a secular age, to invite people into an imaginary where they can think in another way, and we think it's good for them to think of themselves as citizens in an Athenian democracy or in a res publica, we might also invite them to think of themselves as living in even an imaginary way for a brief period of time as a thought experiment, in a culture in which you actually look at the other person as made in the image of God, in which you see yourself subject to a kind of ethical examination of conscience which is universal, which says in Psalm 15, it says, who shall ascend to the holy hill of the Lord? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not slandered his neighbor, and who has kept his word even unto his own hurt. That's a worthy standard for thought experiment too.